You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House. Coming to you live from Studio One, I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's program.
President Pierre Nkurunziza has been dismissed as president of Burundi, and the government of Burundi has been relieved of its powers.
A Burundian general says he sacked the country's president for seeking an unconstitutional third term. The leader's people describe the news as a joke. So who is laughing? My guests Daniela Pellet and James Schneider will be with me to give their view. Also on the programme, the UK's returning Prime Minister says Britain has been a passively tolerant society for too long as he sets out to combat extremism. We'll ask if he's right and what tolerance means anyway. Plus, Palestine's Football Association seeks to bar Israel from the international game. And we'll also ask how polite politicians should be to vexatious constituents who happen to be heir to the throne. That's all coming up on Midori House right now on Monocle 24. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellet, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and James Schneider, editorial director at New African Magazine. Welcome both, and we shall start tonight with Burundi, where, depending on whom you believe, President Pierre Nkurunziza has either been overthrown by the country's military or, alternatively, not. Earlier today, Burundi's recently sacked intelligence chief, Major General Godefroy Niyombare, announced that he had dismissed the president and would establish a transitional government. An aide to the president, who is undertaking a perhaps ill-advised visit to Tanzania, dismissed this claim as a joke. James, first of all, it would be far from the first time that an African president has left the country and had someone attempt to change the locks in his absence. What do we actually know about what has occurred this afternoon?
So We'll find out pretty much for sure whether the coup is successful really very soon, because Nkurunziza is meant to be on a plane back from Dar es Salaam to Bujumbura, and the coup leaders say that the airport's closed and the borders are closed. So if he gets in, maybe no coup. If he doesn't get in, well, then very much a coup. What's happened? He's out of the country on a regional meeting. He's been trying to push for this third term. The other countries in the regional bloc, so that's like Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya and Tanzania, they're not so keen on him going for this unconstitutional third term. They said, let's have a meeting, come out of the country. He does so, and then there's a coup.
What is your sense, again, as far as it's possible to tell? Reports are extremely conflicting and confused. Do you get the sense that Major General Niyombare has just gone off on one here, or is it possible that neighbouring countries might have waved this one through on the quiet?
I think the latter is quite likely. I think I would be surprised if Rwanda and Uganda especially didn't know that this was going to happen or that this was possible. To just backtrack slightly, a couple of weeks ago, the Burundian army put out this quite measured statement, effectively warning Nkurunziza, don't go for a third term. They said that no individual was above the constitution. They warned him against it. And he just decided to ignore this. And he pushed it through the constitutional court, which said, no, actually, he's allowed to break the constitution. That's fine. He can run for another term. And in the background, both Rwanda and Tanzania and Uganda and also South Africa, because it was Thabo Mbeki who negotiated the end of the civil war back in 2005, they've all been saying that he shouldn't do this. And the African Union came out quite strongly, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, the chairperson, saying that there should not be a third term. So it would be unlikely if there hadn't been some form of at least nods and winks between the outside parties, the regional parties and the army.
Because at the heart of this is the question of that third term. And President Nkurunziza has been slightly cute with it, claiming that because, if I've got this right, he was appointed to his first term, not elected. So that one doesn't really count.
Yeah, that's what he says. So the confusion, there's the peace agreement, the Arusha peace agreement, which says president is two terms, no more, that's it. The constitution says president is two terms elected by universal suffrage. The constitution is trying to say you've got to be elected by universal suffrage. It's not trying to say, well, your first term because you're appointed by parliament doesn't count. So that's why he's tried to be cute with it. But he knows that it's, or he must realise that it's not okay, because he tried to amend the constitution to give him another term in parliament last year, and it was actually voted down. He lost by one vote.
Daniela, as a general point, and we should probably try to extrapolate a couple of general points while we wait to see whether the president's plane is actually allowed land in his capital or not. Why do you think it is such a thing, especially with developing democracies, that people in charge have such a hard time walking away? Because democracy doesn't really work unless the guy in charge goes when it's his time to go.
Yeah, because they don't want to, and if they can get and if they can get away with it, then they will so do. I mean, that's characteristic of any kind of power struggle. I mean, and not even in developing democracies, people just expect there to be a transition of power, but generally people don't go until they're pushed. And it's very depressing to see the scenes unfolding in Burundi. You see people celebrating, people jubilant that the president has gone, and all the usual accoutrements of revolution, the internet shut down, the arms of communication are seized. I mean, also what's been proposed is, I think, a transitional government of salvation. I mean, that's got a pretty worrying ring to it as well.
I like the sound of a government of salvation. That shows ambition. That's commendable, isn't it?
Well, it's Niyambaro's way of saying that this isn't just going to be the army. He came out quite quickly and he said, we're civil society with religious leaders and some of the political opposition, because the civil society is actually very strong and very well organised in Burundi. And they spent a lot of the last 2 years in the courts and in the street campaigning against Nkurunziza having a third term. So that's his way of saying, this isn't just my transition, this is civil society's transition.
I mean, it is tempting to think of the old school military coup d'etat as, and as Daniela pointing out, this is adhering to most of the traditional choreography as something of an anachronism. But I did a quick ransacking of the wires. In the last 5 years, by my count, in Africa, there have been coups or attempted coups in Niger, Madagascar, Egypt, DRC, Guinea-Bissau, Mali a couple of times, Malawi, Ivory Coast, Sudan, Benin, Chad, Libya, Lesotho, and Gambia. Again, as a general point, Daniela, is there actually ever, under any circumstances, a role to play for the military as an actual guarantor of democracy, or do we get into a weird area straight away there?
Well, in theory, that's the scenario. In Turkey, for instance, the army is supposed to be the guarantor of secularism.
Which is why Erdogan has put so very many of them in jail.
Yes, yes. So it's not ideal in a system of checks and balances that one of the largest of them should be the army. But you know, that seems to be a compromise in some places. And there are people, you know, you look towards Egypt, whether you call it a coup or not, there are a lot of Egyptians who did support the army coming back in and taking power. And certainly in the first revolution, the army seemed very quickly to be on the side of the people. So they play an interesting role, but I don't think they can play a very serious role in a functioning democracy.
I think it works well as a threat. If it has to be carried out, then it starts to become a bit problematic. The army in Senegal, for example, was very important in getting Wade, when he lost the election, to go. Likewise, recently in Malawi and also Zambia, it's played the same role. The head of the military goes and says, no, seriously, you've lost, you've got to go. And I think that, as a sort of transitionary thing, moving towards bedding in constitutionalism, is a proactive and positive role that militaries can play. Also, we saw, and then if there are attempts to subvert the constitution, as we're seeing here, this is possibly a positive role. And in Burkina Faso, just a few months ago, that was certainly a positive role that the military played in backing the revolutionary forces, the protesters, against their president, also trying to seek another term.
Just a final thought on this story, James, and a relatively brief one, if you could. Tempting though it always is to regard the coup d'etat as something of a comic opera romp. This could turn out to be entirely the opposite, couldn't it? I mean, how ugly could this potentially get?
It could. Nkurunziza still has support. He has loyalists in the army, and he's got this youth wing militia, which is potentially pretty scary. So if it turns into a fight, it could get nasty, but it's not, fortunately, it's not ethnicised. This isn't going to fall down along the same kind of lines that the civil war did.
Okay. Well, let's move along to, well, actually, that's not so much move along as come back to where we're sitting, which is the UK, which is still adjusting to a change of government almost as surprising. Nobody expected David Cameron's Conservative Party to win a clear majority, least of all David Cameron's Conservative Party, which may account for a somewhat mixed message today. David Cameron claiming that Britain has for too long been a, quote, passively tolerant society, followed swiftly by Home Secretary Theresa May suggesting that tolerance was indeed a British value. Cameron's complete quote was, "For too long, we have been a passively tolerant society saying to our citizens, as long as you obey the law, we will leave you alone." Daniela, he said that like it's a bad thing. Isn't that, that's pretty much the deal, isn't it?
I wonder if one of his speechwriters is going to get a bit of a rap on the knuckles. Yeah, how can you, how exactly are you supposed to legislate against people who have bad thoughts, who don't break the law? I mean, it's completely nonsensical. I think he's laid himself open to a bit of ridicule for this. I mean, they're trying to make a point that they are the law and order party, and they're not going to be soft anymore. It does seem to be that the Liberal Democrats perhaps should have had a little bit of credit for reining in the Conservative on some points, which is their major claim to have had any impact in the last government.
But why do British governments keep doing this? Because it's not merely a Conservative trope. Labour under Tony Blair tried to get up this ridiculous law against incitement to religious hatred, whatever that actually meant, which was mercifully scuppered in the House of Lords. But why this you know, incessant insistence on exactly as you say, trying to police what people are thinking?
I think one of our benefits of the United Kingdom, and perhaps another flaw, is that we don't really know what we are and what we stand for. We just have a vague idea of what it means to be British, and we don't like to test it too much. And when we do test it, we come up with ideas like this. I mean, this is all very thinly veiled, not even that thinly, saying we're worried about Islamic extremism, we want to do something about it. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So anything that comes along and theoretically threatens this fairly calm and decent and quiet way of going about things, we're not really equipped to deal with it.
It's always struck me, certainly speaking as an outsider or the one who's been here for a long time, that whenever you run up against a British government, and they've all done it in the time I've lived here, tried to come up with some way of codifying British values, that in itself strikes me as an extremely un-British thing to do.
Yes, I think that's probably right, which is why it never works at all, and it always comes across as quite... It's either menacing or it's cringeworthy. There's no there's no middle ground.
Occasionally
with it.
Both.
Yeah, well, I think this is... I think this is both. I mean, this is... it doesn't make any logical sense. It's very clearly... I mean, the bit of that quote, if you carry it on, he says that it's... that apparently this passive tolerance has helped foster a narrative of extremism and grievance. So really what you want to do to prevent a narrative of grievance is create laws which are only used against Muslims. That sounds really, really good.
We need to be aggressively tolerant, perhaps. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Before the election, I was interviewing a UKIP candidate and their whole platform...
Somebody had to,
indeed. It was quite good for comedy value. And their whole platform talks about promoting inclusive British identity. And I asked him, OK, what does this mean, this inclusive British identity? And he hummed and he hawed. And I think the three things he came up with were cricket, queuing and tolerance, which is
sounds like John Major.
So UKIP's idea of heaven is queuing to get into the cricket and not complaining about it.
Yeah, perhaps. If only that's all. That's all that it was. And I think what's alarming now, we're going to have a lot of this over the next couple of years as we move towards an EU referendum. I mean, enough of it came up when we were talking about the Scottish referendum. All of a sudden, we have to define ourselves and our various constituency and our parts and what it means to be British or English or Scottish. And I don't think that does us any favours. I don't think nationalism is something that is a discussion I don't think that we need to have it. I don't think it bothers us terribly much. And by discussing it, making it an issue, I think it's quite harmful in a way.
The word tolerant always, it just always strikes me as an under-considered idea, that tolerance is always considered as a virtue. It's actually quite an ugly word. Tolerant means I'm basically grudgingly agreeing to put up with you, which does seem like a weird way to regard one's fellow citizens.
Another way of putting it, I guess, but it sounds really old-fashioned, is fair play. I think that's probably a better way of characterising general culture in Britain. But I really do think it would be refreshing if the government would just say, OK, we're talking about Islamic extremism. That's it. We're not talking about the French people coming and living in London and, you know, importing their culture of eating fancy cheeses and fresh bread from the bakery every day. They're talking about Islamic extremism, and they're not. I think partly this sort of coyness of trying of tackling it is part of the problem.
That very point struck me as well, James. I mean, what do you think of that? That idea of, I mean, why not just say we're worried about Islamic extremism and we are going to take steps to attempt to discourage it?
Well, that's pretty much what he's said, but it has to be covered in this sort of sheen, because we're meant to be a liberal society where everyone's equal under the law, and so at least in theory you can't just go out and say, well, we're creating a whole load of laws which only apply to Muslims, because how on earth would that sit
couldn't
legally?
They just say we're just creating laws which only apply to Islamic extremists who may pose a danger to the rest of us?
But there are already laws for those, and you tend to not want.
True enough.
I mean, the whole thing is that the whole thing doesn't work. It's the same thing as the religious hatred. There are laws that cover people inciting violence to other people, which cover all of this stuff. When you try to get this extra level, you bring in all of these ways for the state to do pretty much what it likes in discriminatory and individualized ways, rather than having a general law which applies to everyone, which everyone can interact with fairly.
I mean, just as a final thought on this, and I'll ask you both the same question, why does Britain, I think more than any other country I know of, get in such a muddle when it tries to define itself? I mean, America, for example, has absolutely no lack of confidence about what American values are and what it means to be American. The country I come from, Australia, has become increasingly confident on that front. Most European countries have that sort of confidence. Daniela, I'll ask you first, why doesn't Britain, and is it indeed even a bad thing?
I wouldn't call it a lack of confidence. I would call it diffidence. That's a much nicer angle of putting it. We are a nation of immigrants. I think all three of us sitting around in this studio, our roots are not in Britain. That doesn't stop me feeling super British, super English, and very well integrated. So I think things which are not defined are somehow more inclusive. I don't have to say that I play cricket, I wait in queues, and I'm tolerant to belong here. I just do.
I think empire and class both make an understanding of British identity, or British nationalism, really difficult. Britain's obviously a really class-riven society, and any of these discussions of nationalism, either Scottish nationalism, some attempts at English nationalism, are either ways of trying to express some of that that class unease, or there are ways to try to get over it. And I think that's why none of them really makes that much sense on their own terms, and aren't really based in history in a more meaningful way, or narratives about history, like, say, American nationalism is. And the other thing, like, British identity is something that holds together, has been kind of falling apart since the demise of empire. And that is not an identity which we can have anymore, quite rightly so. And therefore, if you can't really talk about your history in an entirely positive sense without being quite unpleasant, what do you do? And we haven't had that conversation. We haven't admitted to ourselves how appalling colonialism was, and so we can't come up with a positive identity.
Well, you can start by apologising for shipping my ancestors away in chains for stealing
you
bread.
You did all right out of it.
Yeah, well, we will take a short break on that happy and inclusive note. You are listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pallad and James Schneider. Coming up, we'll be whipping out our letter opener and a very strong pot of coffee to take a look at some royal correspondence.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Well, Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Daniela Pellet and James Schneider. And we're staying in the UK for the next item as well, because as members of Britain's Parliament will know, one of the drawbacks of their job is the necessity of fielding correspondence from bores and dingbats who think they know everything. A trove of exactly this has been released today under the Official Secrets Act and would prompt the coverage it deserves, i.e. none, were it not for the identity of the author, the Prince of Wales, some of whose letters to Labour ministers have been released today after a decade-long campaign by British newspapers. Daniela, the Prince of Wales appears to be keen on badges, New Age therapies, less so on modern architecture. We knew all this, didn't we?
Don't forget the Patagonian
toothfish.
Yes, exactly.
That is a revelation.
Oh, but apart from new.
Well, in that it was news to me that the Patagonian toothfish existed.
Quite.
But apart from that, have we learnt anything from this?
I am terribly disappointed by the context of this letter. I thought after the decade-long fight that it would be all kinds of saucy stuff, or at least things which would, you know, reveal him as a terrible meddling buffoon. I'm not a monarchist. I would have been quite happy for him to be shown in a more negative light, because I don't really think that he has any, as the monarch potentially in future, I don't think he has any right in interfering in the business of government in even the most discreet way. I think the problem with what's been revealed is that actually it shows him as a kind of slightly bumbling, slightly officious, sort of doddering old chat, which will likely endear him more to the British public rather than less.
I did kind of enjoy, I have to say, the very thinly veiled tone of the replies from Tony Blair in particular. You can hear him sighing between lines. It kind of increased your admiration for the former Prime Minister, I thought. James, Clarence House, home of Charles's courtiers, say that the publication of private letters can only inhibit his ability to express concerns and suggestions which have been put to him in the course of his travels and meetings. Is this a bad thing?
In
inhibiting him.
I can't see how inhibiting Prince Charles is a problem for anyone. It's probably good for the eyesight of the poor permanent private secretary who has to read them out loud to the minister. It's probably better for all of us. The idea that he has some wonderful constitutional role of going round and talking to people, and then he's the middleman between the great people and, you know, the minister in their ivory tower away making rules about badgers and that fish that you
Patagonian
said that
toothfish.
I kind of think you just made up.
No, it's a thing.
Okay.
Apparently.
Fine. Well, and he loves it or doesn't love it. He has an opinion about it, but I forget which, to be honest. I don't think that he was walking down the street in Wandsworth or in anywhere else and someone said to him, oh, you know, hi Charles, I'm really concerned about the Patagonian starfish.
Toothfish.
sorry. The Patagonian toothfish.
There's a starfish as well. This goes deeper than I thought.
Will you please write a letter to Gordon Brown and make sure he does something about it?
Daniela, do you think, I mean, elaborating on your earlier point there, that the royal family and associated powers have actually made this more of a story than it needed to be by fighting so hard for so long to keep this secret?
Absolutely, and raising all our expectations. I was looking forward to this. I was pressing refresh on my computer. Yeah.
Were you hoping there would be the paw print of an intergalactic lizard from a parallel dimension?
That was beyond
at the bottom of each one.
That was beyond my expectations. But really, I mean, this is. I don't see why his privacy is such an immense deal. It shouldn't be. They made an enormous fuss out of it. These weren't private letters. You know, he's let some quite private things out of the bag before. He shouldn't be, as the incoming monarch, he shouldn't be trying to push his views on anything. He can have an opinion. And the problem is that Charles really believes that is his role. And he spent his whole life working up to these opinions. And when he becomes king, I'm worried that we're going to see like an enormous influx of ideas and schemes and Poundburys. And I think he should stick to baking shortbread biscuits. Apparently they're quite nice.
Just a final thought on this one, James. Does this actually undermine him as a potential monarch? Because one thing that is interesting about his mother, the Queen, is that everything we may think about what she believes and what she thinks is pure guesswork. We simply don't know. She has been, whatever you may think about a monarch, the absolute soul of discretion.
Yes, it probably doesn't help. But then the monarchy doesn't rest in the kind of the realm of the rational. It's the realm of the symbolic. And I think that that support for Charles or otherwise will not come down to kind of cold logic about is it sensible to have a monarchy in the 21st century in Britain, and more about pageantry and how lovely is the royal wedding.
Okay, well, we should move along to our final story tonight, which is that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has erupted along an interesting new front, with a bid by the Palestine Football Association to have Israel ejected from FIFA, the sport's global governing body, due to alleged breaches of rules permitting freedom of movement for athletes. Daniela, is this spot of troublemaking by the Palestinian Football Association worthwhile? Is it going to get them anywhere?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very, very clever tactical move. If I knew more about football, I would insert an analogy there. But this is a very good example of their ability to use diplomatic measures, you know, non-violent, legal resistance, raising the issue in the court of public opinion, and Israel's complete and utter inability to deal with it. The idea is that Palestinian footballers, they're in the West Bank, Gaza, and some of them are Palestinian citizens of Israel, are the national team. They're restrictions on their movement means that it's difficult to pass checkpoints to play games or attend matches or leave the country, the various countries that they are, to play abroad. Israel contends that this is for security reasons and has tried very hard to produce examples of Palestinian footballers involved in terror, although they haven't done very well to come up with examples so far. Now, whether this will pass or not is highly unlikely. I think 75% of FIFA members need to agree to it. But it's raised the issue and raised it in a forum where Israel really can't say much about it. You know, there is no...
They don't have a specific rebuttal, no. The Israeli Football Association chief, Ofer Einy, has called it, with hilarious ingenuousness, a flagrant move which seeks to mix politics with sport, as if that ever happens.
Yeah, quite. But also, I mean, the head of the Palestinian Football Association, Jibril Rajoub, is a former West Bank Fatah strongman. He's a very smart political operator. I mean, it is all about politics, but I don't see any problem with that.
Well, I mean, it's certainly preferable to them waging their campaign against Israel by this means than one or two others they've tried. James, should FIFA be acting in moral judgment against its member states, though? I mean, there is always the precedent of South Africa, which I know is a comparison Israel is famously unkeen on. But does FIFA actually have a role to play here?
And I think in the case of South Africa, sporting boycotts were obviously important and were the right thing to do, and they came very late in the day. But then you look at who leads FIFA and you think, do they have a moral authority to make judgment on anything? So, I mean, it's open.
Daniela, what would public reaction in is? I mean, is this being taken seriously in Israel, and how seriously would it be taken if, by some mischance, they actually got this through?
I don't think sports has the same sort of level of public feeling in Israel as it does as it did in South Africa. But certainly, the whole issue of boycott, divestment, sanctions is incredibly sensitive in Israel. And I think it's something that unites Jewish Israelis across the left and the centre and the right. Apart from the very far left, no one is in favour of boycotts of Israel. And in fact, the government passed a law, and the Supreme Court confirmed it, making it a civil offence to call for the boycott of any Israeli institution, whether within the occupied territories or within Israel. This is possibly the most sensitive issue on Israel's table right now. And I'm afraid that the public will see it as just an example that the world is out to get them.
Just a very, very final thought on this, James, and a reasonably brief one. Is there a risk that from the Palestinian perspective that this kind of tactic risks trivialising the issue, as it were? If people think that this is what it's come down to, maybe it's not that serious after all.
Probably not, actually. I think they're trying to cause difficulties for Israel and keep it in the international eye through these means, because negotiations clearly hasn't worked, and they're trying to change the balance of support in the world a bit more in their favour before the next time any kind of meaningful negotiations can happen.
We will have to leave it there. James Schneider, Daniela Peled, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's edition. The show was produced by Alice Block, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carolina Margren. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Josh Fennett is here with Monocle's International Playlist. He's followed at 1900 by Daniel Giacopelli with The Entrepreneurs. At 2200, it's the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Nancy Durham. This show will be back tomorrow at 1800 time, also hosted by me, I think I'm right in saying. But for this edition, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Muller. Thank you very much for listening.